I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, a free-willing discussion about literature, the left, and liberation by way of militant joy, with Tyler Walasek and Mel Gammy of Protean Magazine. Protean Magazine is an exciting new collaborative creative project, a completely ad-free endeavor. Protean Magazine describes itself as collecting cutting-edge literature and art for the discerning leftist. The magazine's print edition is published biannually, while web content is released on a weekly basis. The first issue of Protean Magazine is also available now as we speak and is subtitled Pattern Machines. Said issue deals with technology and addiction in the 21st century. So if you enjoy the following conversation, please be sure to check that out. As per usual here on Parallax Views, we attempt to cover a lot of ground and go into multiple different directions, including the impetus behind and goals for Protean Magazine, the need to pay writers, something that Tyler and Mel, as well as myself, feel very strongly about, the wild world of podcasting. Side note here, Mel is actually the co-host of a podcast that I recommend you listen to. It's called Coffee with Comrades, and she will be working on a podcast for Protean Magazine as well. So look forward to that, folks, if you enjoy the following conversation. We also discuss social media pros and cons, irony versus sincerity debates, meme culture, and, of course, a whole discussion around literature, with a focus on genre, the problems of new criticism, and the attempts by the alt-right to insert themselves into the world of literature, including mention of a certain character that goes by the name of Matt Forney. Matt, if you are, for some reason that I could not fathom listening to this, you two-bit hack that tries to rip off John Dolan, who you can't hold a candle to, and furthermore, never will hold a candle to, because at the end of the day, you're a schmuck, a rip-off artist. Hell, I can't even use the term artist to describe you. That's an insult to actual artists. And most of all, you're a two-bit hack. And with that being said, on to our conversation with Protean Magazine's Tyler and Mel. Welcome to Parallax Views, Mel and Tyler of Protean Magazine.
Hey.
Hey, great to be here.
How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. I'm very interested in this magazine you guys have put together. You have the first issue out, and it's called Pattern Machines, Volume 1, Issue 1, Pattern Machines. Maybe, though, for my listeners that are unfamiliar with Protean, Tyler, you could tell my listeners a little bit about what Protean is about, and also, Mel, if you want to chime in as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started Protean because we didn't see an avenue on the left that provides a space for criticism, essays, fiction, and art, and poetry. There's a very stable of leftist magazines that do some of those, but we saw a niche where we could fit a new kind of style, and we took it. And it started as a germ of an idea, and we've been watching it grow ever since. So, yeah, like you said, last year we put out our first issue. We're putting together our second right now, and it's proven to be a pretty sustainable project.
Yeah, I mean, there's both the print side of things, and then there's an online side. So a lot of our articles and essays and fiction and such that don't make it into the print magazine are published online as well. So we have quite a few different avenues that we're creating a platform for leftist thinkers and artists and writers to be able to make use of.
Well, I was going to say, maybe we can do some individual introductions as well, if you guys want to state who you are and you know, sort of what you're looking to accomplish with Protean and other projects that you're involved in. Mel, if you want to start with that one, since we gave the first question to Tyler.
Sure. My name's Mel. I'm a freelance journalist and graduate student. I live in the Midwest. I've been organizing and sort of writing in leftist spaces for a number of years now, and I got started in the Protean project by publishing some scathing critiques about Extinction Rebellion back in April, I think, and went on an international reporting trip for Protean to France to sit with the Gilets Jaunes and march in one of their protests recently in May, I think. And in the last month or so was asked to join the editorial team as the associate editor, and am now working on other projects for Protean as we continue to expand.
Yeah, absolutely. I am also a freelance writer and journalist, and I've been doing various left-ish things for several years now. I did some work with DSA San Francisco after graduating from college, but I soon discovered that I'm less of an organizer and more of a writer, so I've been trying to put together journalism and criticism of my own for a good while, but it wasn't until I founded Protean with Stephen Monticelli, who's another DSASF member, that things really started to come together. So I've discovered this little place in leftist publishing where I'm really happy and I like to be. So, you know, we're hoping that can be a project that sticks around going forward.
Well, you know, looking up the definition of Protean, it means it's an adjective that means tending or able to change frequently or easily. Why that specific word to sort of sum up your intentions with the magazine?
Well, I think it speaks to how we want to provide different avenues of content while also remaining versatile and able to change in any way that we need to. Luckily, we have an editorial team who's really dedicated and works all volunteer at the moment. So they've been super effective in helping this get off the ground. And we hope to be able to translate it into different forms in the future. I think, I'm not sure if you mentioned it yet, Mel, but we are expanding into podcasts and trying to print some additional publications on the side. and generally seeing where it goes. So we don't really pin it to any one particular definition. We're just doing what we love and publishing stuff we think is really cool and seeing where that takes us.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about publications tending to pigeonhole themselves in various types of just one avenue or niche or another. And the cool thing about the Protean Project is that it's, you know, primarily print, but it can be sort of moved into other sorts of imprints, if you will, like printing, like doing zines, like podcasting, like things like that. And I think it kind of speaks to the sort of variable nature of the project and the sort of platform that we're trying to provide for people in leftist media so that they have something that they can, that they're good at, that they can tap into, and that we can help them, you know, find an outlet for.
Are either of you influenced by any chance by, you know, the Situationists? Because they also had a thing where they would get involved in multiple mediums, whether it was, like, you know, board games or film or, you know, writing manifestos. They were sort of all over the place.
Huh. You know, I hadn't made that connection before, but I did read a lot of Situationist theory in college, and the Society of the Spectacle was pretty formative for my leftism. So, you know, maybe some of that made its way in there. I think right now we're pretty much sticking to written and perhaps audio formats. But who knows? I mean, we could expand into board games and theme parks. Sky's
a Protean RPG. That'd be so cool.
I'm sold.
I don't know. I feel like most creative types tend to branch out and sort of stick their feet in all sorts of ponds. So it's not particularly, I don't think it's any particular political philosophy or philosophy in general that sort of moves us. Well, I guess I can only speak for myself, but, you know, I write poetry and I'm a journalist and I do podcasting. And those are all things that I find really fulfilling. And I think a lot of the people who contribute to this project also do similar things. So I don't know. Maybe it's just because we live in a shitty capitalist society that forces us to be a jack of all trades in order to make our money. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely felt myself forced into marketing writing and corporate writing in order to survive, but it's always been centered around creating stuff and, you know, doing basically what we're doing now. And so it is something that drives me. So it's a lot of it comes out of our dedication as an editorial board and our love for doing it. But in terms of the name, I mean, I think Protean also references the kind of content that we're willing to take, in that it's not just that it's poetry, criticism, or fiction. It's that we will accept anything we think is cool and is decently written and conveyed. And we don't limit ourselves to a certain avenue of criticism or of, you know, like Mel said, political thought. We're definitely multi-tendency, though squarely on the left. But basically, I mean, if people write us with a pitch that we think is cool and that adequately critiques capitalism, we'll likely run it.
Right.
And that gives us a way to support writers who are not big names, who are just starting out or don't have all the bylines. And it's a way for us to help them support themselves and channel some resources to them, as well as get their voice heard. So, I mean, I think the Protean moniker, while it doesn't necessarily refer to our sprawling media empire yet, it mainly means that we're adaptable to working with people and the stories that they want to tell.
Well, I was going to add to that. I like that, you know, you guys have a pretty broad range with regards to the type of people that can submit. You know, I mean, you're squarely on the left, but I mean, people who don't realize that the left has many different, you know, there's so many different sort of sects within the left, and there can be a lot of infighting at times. So it's kind of cool to see a magazine that's trying to sort of bring people together rather than, you know, divide and conquer.
Yeah, I mean, well, we all certainly have our own views, but they all work together pretty harmoniously, because I think at the core, the left is driven by the same empathy and desire for justice, even if we disagree about ways to go about it. So while you might not see us publishing any hardcore Marxist-Leninist Maoist takes, we definitely draw from different anarchists and socialist tendencies.
Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Mel? Just I want to give you a chance to speak as well.
Well, I try my best to sort of, in my own personal politics, eschew the sort of sectarianism that is pretty pervasive on the internet. And I think that this project does a really good job at sort of providing that space for anyone to throw their thoughts out into the void to be discussed and chewed on. And, you know, even the sort of critiques that we publish or that we discuss amongst ourselves on the editorial board run the gamut, you know, and it's nice to be able to create a platform that is not so broad that we become vague and inconsequential, but is wide enough and open enough for anyone with the chops, the writing chops, really, and an opinion that's strong enough to be able to voice that opinion and put it out in the sort of digital public square, if you will. And I think that's really cool. And I think that's really a central piece of the project itself.
You know, that sort of leads me to, I know, Tyler, you in particular wanted to talk about the way in which Protean is sort of organized and the principles it's organized around. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about that, because it's organized differently than, you know, I think what people sort of in the more mainstream publishing world would expect.
Yeah, I mean, I think we try to live by a each according to their abilities philosophy. So we have a team of about 8 people right now who are doing various things according to their strengths. All is volunteer. You know, we'd like to be able to make a living doing this someday, but for now the focus is on the creators. So all our funds get channeled to printing, shipping, or paying writers primarily. So that involves a lot of work in keeping the website up and putting out consistent content, and creating a print magazine. But like we talked about, you know, it's really something we're driven by just passion and our own energy for. But we allow, I mean, everyone brings to the table as much as they want to. No one is really tasked with anything as much as people step up to the plate and things just get done, because we're all on the same page and we all have basically the same motivations. So even though, you know, there are semi-official titles of like who's an editor and who's a director or whatever, it doesn't mean a whole lot, and everyone can contribute as much or little as they please. So somehow, you know, all the work gets done anyways. It's almost like people doing work that they value of their own volition gets things done in society.
Yeah, I would say it's a pretty horizontal power structure among the editorial team. Like Tyler said, you know, we are all on the same page and we all sort of have bought into the vision of what Protean is and what we want to accomplish with Protean. And so doing that work is a fantastic, sometimes hectic, mostly hilarious, really awesome labor of love, right? And, you know, eventually, hopefully, we'll reach a point where we can pay ourselves. But until that point, you know, our focus really is on the creators. You know, we don't take anything to publish for for our either print or online that we have not paid for, and we have not paid a fair wage for each of our creators that we contract with. And we work really hard to make sure that what we are taking does get paid. You know, these creators do get paid fairly and they aren't left out to dry, because of a huge problem with digital media and working with freelancers in larger publications is that writers aren't paid on time. They're not paid a fair wage. They're, you know, screaming into email inboxes for peanuts. And that's not the type of thing that any of us creators on the editorial board really like, or, you know, ever have like relished. And that's not something that we want to give to the creators that choose to pitch to us. You know, they put a lot of work into the articles and the critiques and the poetry and the fiction that they send to us. And so we want to be able to pay them for what is essentially a very hard labor to do, particularly as a creative, you know. And I think that that's definitely something that all of us feel incredibly strongly about.
Yeah, it's always been really weird to me because I've done writing as well, and it's always been really weird to me when, you know, I'll get real riled up about, you know, even like a mainstream sort of Democrat or progressive outlet like, you know, Huffington Post, basically telling people, well, if you write for us, you'll get the exposure, but we're not going to pay you.
Yeah,
I mean, it just blows my mind.
It's insane. I can't believe that, you know, big name mastheads are treating freelancers like that and paying them. You know, I've heard people being paid like a couple $100 for a New York Times article that got, you know, hundreds of thousands of views. That's just untenable. It's something that, you know, we hope we can remedy. Our budget is shoestring right now, but we at least like to think that we've helped, you know, a freelancer writer make rent one month by giving them some work and paying them on time. So, yeah, the situation in media, as we've watched from the sidelines, is just, it's absolutely a shit show. I think Mel actually was the impetus behind us joining the IWW Freelance Journalist Union, which myself and our other editor-in-chief, Stephen, are recent additions to. But I know that one of their main focuses is working on the time in which freelancers get paid and pressing media companies to step up and stop doing the dangling a check in front of you for months bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge, huge problem. And the problem is that these larger publications will publish all of this great leftist critique, right? I think of like Teen Vogue, right? That publishes, you know, the labor union column, right? And
yeah,
and has all these, yep, and has all these amazing articles about Marx and all, and the things that we would like to see as part of a larger mainstream media discourse. But then you get into, you know, conversations in various channels where some columnists have not been paid for months, right? They've sold multiple articles to these publications and they haven't seen a dime of it. And they're waiting on thousands upon thousands of dollars worth of, you know, work that's been published, that's already been, you know, contracted away. They don't have the rights to it anymore, right? And like, they're not getting their paychecks. And it's like, it's really frustrating because we've all been there, right? And it's like, what's that one? The old writer adage, you'll die of exposure. Why would you get paid in it? You know what I mean? This idea that, oh, well, you'll get hundreds of thousands of views on this, and then maybe some editor will pick you up in 2 years and they'll pay you $500 for, you know, a 1,000-word article that took you 3 weeks to write. That kind of stuff is just absolute trash. It's trash. And I think, you know, we at Protean, even though we are hamstringed by our budget constantly, it's still growing and we are still keeping that, you know, at the forefront of what we do. For this magazine, making sure that we're not one of those shitty publications that promises to pay a writer, you know, benefits from their labor and then doesn't pay them. Like that, no, that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, this is sort of a broader question. I know you guys keep mentioning that you may be a little bit hamstringed by the budget you're working on right now, but I still respect what you're trying to do because, you know, I've seen people at, say, a place like Vice, which has started publishing more, you know, left-wing people like Grim Kim, the sort of black metal leftist. But then they laid everyone off. And the thing that gets me is that all of this has been normalized now. It's seen as normal to not be paid, to be paid in exposure rather than, you know, any kind of actual money for your labor. That's been made a normal thing, and it just boggles my mind. How do you think we got to this point? And also, how did you guys sort of break out of the mentality of, you know, everything has to be a vertical structure? Because I think horizontal structuring is very radical to a lot of people in this country.
Well, I mean, it's a natural progression of capitalism, right? You extract value from someone's labor and pay them peanuts while you make money hand over fist on the profits. Like, when you see these large media companies, they're corporations that have multiple publications under one umbrella, and the people at the top make a fuckload of money. And when certain publications are not producing properly for whatever arbitrary bottom line that they have determined is the correct amount, then they lay people off so they can make more money. You know, it's just that's how the newspaper industry declined. It's how many digital platforms are now going. Like, it all comes down to if certain billionaires and millionaires at the top are not making a profit off of this little pet project of theirs, then they shut down operations and push that money somewhere else. And I think a lot of what we talk about when we talk about horizontal power structures is, you know, because we are leftists and because we naturally have, you know, we've come to a place where we naturally think of these power structures as, you know, inherent in our daily lives and work to build these types of structures in various contexts, that it just seemed like, you know, the logical, rational thing to do for something like a leftist publication, if that makes sense.
Was there any spark for either of you that sort of pushed you leftward? Because I always find that story very fascinating with a lot of my guests. Because like I said, it's sort of like breaking out of I hate this metaphor, but it's like breaking out of the matrix when you start questioning the vertical power structures and the way things are sort of set up and the normalization of certain attitudes. Maybe you want to take that first, Tyler?
Yeah, sure. I was red-pilled onto the left from a decently young age, I guess. But I think it was the jump from liberal to leftist that I didn't really grasp until later in life. So my parents were very conservative. And, you know, as a kid, I was apolitical or confused. Then I became, you know, what you'd call a progressive, I guess, whatever that means. But it wasn't until, you know, late high school or college that I started reading enough and getting a sense of the magnitude of the injustices in the world that I started to look to more radical solutions. So my politics have been cobbled together from a number of sources since then. But they're all animated by the same desire, which is to see justice and to have empathy for other people and to have an accurate picture of the world that's not riven with U.S. propaganda, which we've been fed our entire lives. So there was a lot of unlearning to do, you know, beyond just reading People's History of the United States. But, you know, I wouldn't say I'm an expert on the left. Like, I'm not much of a theory guy, although, you know, I've read the classics. But as far as my beliefs and my criticisms of the world we live in, those are very relevant to my life and my writing and what I want to publish.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of like move into radical leftist politics has always been sort of a weird conversation for me, simply because my own personal journey sort of ping-ponged back and forth from right to left for a while. And I don't know. I would say that the too long didn't read version is I started as a lifestyleist punk anarchist, became incredibly conservative after getting the shit scared out of me at Occupy Denver by a bunch of riot cops, and then slowly but surely found my way back to the left over the last 5 or so years. And for me, it's been a lot of reacting to material conditions in my life. My family is working class poor. You know, we are sort of the type of people that have kind of been trodden on by a large portion of the society that we live in under capitalism. And so a lot of my personal critiques have been born out of personal experience. And I sort of found the theory after the fact that sort of fit with my idea of how best to remedy the situation, if that makes sense. And now, you know, in the last couple of years, it's just sort of been this like dive headfirst into radical politics as a result of our current president, and sort of just I don't know. It's just been the product of a lot of really frank, honest, open conversations with people, a lot of unlearning my own bias and prejudice as, you know, a cis white woman in the United States, and continuing with the project of trying to create a world that isn't full of broken, traumatized individuals due to the system that we live in.
It's interesting that you mention having gone maybe extremely conservative for a while, because my experience was, you know, I was one of those, you know, I think it's a rite of passage for, you know, young white teenaged boys in this country, but you go through that libertarian phase. That mm-hmm. was me when I was, you know, in my teens. And then I sort of had dabbled in the alt-right, and then I was just so horrified by it all that I started moving more and more left, and here I am now. But I just think it's interesting that a lot of us share that similar experience of dabbling in the right, and then for material reasons and other reasons, a lot of people end up moving to the left after, you know, seeing how things really work.
Yeah, I still resent the fact that the right has captured the term libertarian. That's bullshit. It's an anarchist term, and we got to take it back. Mm-hmm. But I definitely had a weird flirtation with libertarianism in my teen years, early teen years. And I think it came from a place of like wanting to believe in freedom, but also just being a fucking idiot and not knowing what that really meant.
Well, the leftists are the ones, we're the ones that actually believe in liberation and emancipation and freedom. It's not the libertarians that believe in that. That's the funny part.
They believe in, like, corporate oligarchy and having our lives fucking dictated by PepsiCo. So, I fuck everything about that. But I can see, like, where it comes from, because I embarrassingly dabbled in that myself as a 14-year-old. But, you know, I think you grow out of it when you learn more about the world and you meet other people who have different experiences. And you learn that, you know, hegemonic power is not only wielded by the government. In fact, corporations wield possibly even more of it, especially in America. So, I mean, that's blatantly obvious. And when you've seen enough of the world, that just kind of unveils itself to you if you're thoughtful and critical and a person who has some modicum of compassion, which the right doesn't, which is why they're soulless weirdo fucks who are stuck on 8chan.
Well, you know, it's really weird, too. Because I always heard the right say, everyone's a leftist until they get a job. And I'm like, no,
bullshit.
Getting a job is what made me a leftist. I saw how horrible these people are.
Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I did a corporate office job for a billionaire boss, and it was just incredibly soul-sucking to watch people, you know, sycophantically suck up to him and to see him lay off 10% of his workforce and then run off and buy a $100 million boat. Just real, like, perverse billionaire shit like that.
Right.
I'll reveal who it was. I used to work as a copywriter for GoPro.
Mm.
And their boss, Nick Woodman, was the highest paid CEO in the country at one point. I think not anymore since the company fucking tanked. But seeing that, I was already anti-capitalist, but I got up close to how a billionaire acts and how he acts around his lower paid staff. And that combined with the fact that the company was paying me fucking peanuts as a contractor with no benefits was definitely galvanized my radicalism, if it wasn't already.
Yeah, I still have nightmares of the beige cubicle in the office with no windows.
Ugh.
There's something about like marketing jobs and copywriting jobs where if you find yourself in an office, it's either some like pseudo open space, there's no privacy whatsoever, kind of like weird, predatory, bright orange and blue college frat house type office, or there's the office that I always ended up in, which has literally nothing on the walls, is all the same infuriating color of beige, and the fluorescent lights give you a fucking headache every time you sit down at your desk. You know, I was writing product descriptions for fucking power tools for months, and it's just ridiculous. Like, no one needs that. No one needs to feel that way, you know, especially as a creator. Like, for us, and I'm sure you feel this too, Tyler, like, as a creator, when you find yourself using something, you know, skills and talent that you've cultivated for years and years and years to convince people to buy shit that they don't need, and, like, do it in a really insidious fashion, as marketing tends to do. Like, that is like the epitome of soul crushing. I hated it. So, I hated every minute of it.
Oh, yeah. I had to adopt the voice of the kind of person who would like go kite surfing or something, because that's the clientele that GoPro caters to. So I was trying to channel like my inner surfboard bro and make as much fun as I could have out of it. But yeah, honestly, like selling my labor and the skill that I went to college for and wanted, you know, and respect the craft deeply of writing and poetry, and like, oh, okay, now I'm writing a Facebook ad where I'm trying to sell people a $500 camera by pretending that I care about, you know, snowboarding.
Right.
It's just, it's completely...
It's madness.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah, I've always been a big fan of Kafka and his sort of portrayal of the corporate work world, because...
It's accurate.
Well, it's like now I know there's neoliberals that are sort of arguing for, oh, we should have businesses where you can, you know, there will be a yoga center at the business so you can go to yoga right after you're done with your shift. And maybe we'll even have like sleeping quarters at the job. And I'm like, you know how this ends? It just ends with like, you don't even get to live in a house anymore. You don't get to live in an apartment. You just live at your job in your cubicle.
Yeah. It ends with you getting paid in scrip and like. Mm-hmm. Eat your prime meals from the prime store as you go to sleep in your prime bunk. It's fucking like, it's neo-feudalism.
That's horrific.
Yeah, well, I mean, even when I would have to work, before I graduated, when I was working a few service industry jobs, I remember one of the places I worked at, they were like, well, we're paying you 10 cents over the minimum wage. Isn't that so nice of us? And I'm like, that's such a slap in the face to brag about that.
God. It's like, take your slop and enjoy it, you hog, you prol.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the attitude that managers take towards their employees is incredibly dehumanizing.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, my own jobs in the service industry were similar. In Nebraska, the tip wage is $2.13 an hour plus tips.
Good Lord.
Yeah. So you have to do a lot of quick math to make sure you actually got paid a legal living wage at the end of your shift, and oftentimes you don't. You know, and you're working 39 hours a week, because if you work 40 hours a week, then you have to like, then the company has to give you health insurance, and fuck that, you know, fuck that, right? And it's like horrific shifts and dealing with just absolute assholes. And, you know, all you want to do is just make rent and go home and sleep. And like, that just becomes your life. And that's not really a fun life to live, you know, especially since we only have one. So.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, it's something I've noticed now when I go out. You know, it's funny. I left a bigger tip for someone when I was out a few weeks ago. It was around Labor Day. And they were like, I can't take that tip. It's too big. Or, you know, they were just like put off by it. And I'm like, well, it's Labor Day. You deserve the tip. And you have people that don't even want to accept tips now because they almost like they're almost trained to feel bad about it. I've had Uber drivers do that. I mean, it's just odd to me.
That is some internalized ideology for sure. But yeah, I mean, I don't think Americans really connect the meaning of Labor Day to, well, what it ostensibly means. Really, I mean, May Day is the real labor holiday. Labor Day, correct me if I'm wrong, Mel, but as I understand it, was cooked up by the government as kind of a pittance to throw to the laborers, kind of like a shallow way to honor them while continuing to, you know, union bust and do what they do behind the scenes.
I mean, there's a lot of historical significance to May 1st, especially in American labor politics. I'm rusty on the history, but I believe that's correct. That Labor Day is this sort of like the federal government's doing it that way. You don't remember the people who were martyred in Chicago. You know, you don't remember who agitated for the 8-hour workday and the 40-hour work week, right?
Like, exactly.
Like the thing with May Day is that there is so much history attached to it. And you don't want people shaking the tree by honoring those people who died for labor movements or in labor movements of the past in the United States. So it's a very insidious way to separate us from a very long and arduous labor legacy, essentially.
Well, you know, Tyler, I wanted to ask you a little bit about issue one of Protean, but first I want to ask Mel. You do a lot of podcasting stuff, Coffee with Comrades, and I guess you'll be doing stuff with Protean. What are your thoughts on where podcasting is going and maybe what you want to accomplish with the medium?
Oh, yeah. This is a fun topic. I talk about this a lot with my friends. Coffee with Comrades is a really cool podcast that I do with Pearson Bolt, who is based in Florida. It's sort of like the sincere posting of left podcasting, I suppose, if you want to call it that.
Amen to that. Amen to that. I am so done with irony-poisoned podcasts.
Yeah. I mean, there's a large contingent of us who are sort of the same mind. My thoughts on podcasting is it is the sort of, let's call it this, it's the labor publishing that you saw, the rash of pamphlets, magazines, and, things, publications of the early, labor movement in the late 19th and early 20th century, except this is the digital age. Right. So this is the medium that we have sort of used in the digital age to continue that sort of work. That isn't to say, obviously, because we work with Protean Magazine, that printing and continuing to provide print materials and written materials is not incredibly important. It's just that podcasting has sort of made its own space. And the cool thing about podcasting and, the digital landscape in general is that anyone can do it. So there's no, for the fucking liberals who will sit there and gatekeep about what is and isn't a good podcast, suck ass, and they can just go somewhere else. Because this, anyone who has an idea, a laptop, and a microphone can make a podcast, which is the cool thing about it. If you have something that you want to talk about that is important to you, then you should be able to. Right. I do not own this space. None of us on the left own this space. I will never talk shit on someone who wants to create a leftist podcast, no matter what the subject matter is, because it's a place to share ideas. And the cool thing also about podcasting is that it's creating this space communally where we encourage our listeners, and I will continue to do so with the Protean podcast, whatever we decide to name it. We will, we encourage our listeners to sit down together and listen to a podcast episode together, pause it at points, talk, discuss, chew on these ideas that we're putting out, right? I don't claim to be an expert in anything that I talk about because I'm not really, I'm not. But it's nice to be able to sort of contribute to a larger discourse on what it means to be a leftist, what it means to participate in this sort of ideology, what it means to participate in the larger, American political scene, and, as it ripples outwards. And with Protean, with the podcast that, we're talking about and really working on, we're going to try and release it in late October. My spooky goth self wants it to be October 31st. So hopefully we can get this shit rolling so that people have a spooky Halloween episode as the first Protean episode. But what we really want to do is we want to provide a further platform for our writers. So we'll be doing interviews with writers who have published with us in the past. Maybe there's some part of something that they've published with us that they couldn't fit into 9,000 words. I'm thinking of Stephen and his super, super long article that they want to expand on. Maybe there's another project that they're working on that they want to be able to have a platform to talk about. We want to be able to talk about, what goes on behind closed doors in the Slack channel, and have like editorial roundtables. And we also want to be able to sort of curate this digital media dump, essentially, of other leftist publications, podcasts that we listened to that we loved, things that maybe we wish we published but didn't, things like that, that sort of create a larger, more broad, independent leftist media discourse, right? There's so much to talk about there. We're still figuring out the kinks of what we need to get done in order to create a content schedule. And so I'll have more ideas with that as check Twitter, but that's sort of where we're at. And we also want to be able to provide a reason for people to sign up for our Patreon, because our Patreon is essentially what we are using to pay our writers. That is our main source of donations for our writers monthly for our budget. And so if people have more of a reason to join our Patreon because there's podcast episodes on it, then that means we have a larger budget to pay our writers to publish more great fucking shit. So it's all connected within the larger Protean media empire, I suppose, if that's what we're going to call it. Did I miss anything, Tyler? I mean,
I think you said that really well, Mel. I just want to reiterate that we have no idea what we're doing and we're totally new at this. So you should trust us with your money.
Exactly.
I want to add to that. It's funny because I like what you had to say there, Mel, about, you know, anyone can do a podcast. And it's like, you know, people always ask me, because I mainly do podcasts with different guests from all over the place. My podcast is all over the map. And people are like, well, how did you get so-and-so on? And, you know, I know this is giving away the game, but what I always tell them is I emailed them or I called them on the phone.
DM them on Twitter, like,
Yeah, that's how we've managed to assemble what we think is like a dream team of new and emerging, or emerging and established writers for our second issue. You know, people would follow us on Twitter and I would DM them saying, hey, I really like your work. Do you want to pitch to us? And turns out, shockingly enough, writers are looking for work and they want to get paid for it, especially when there's minimal editorial intervention in what they're saying. And especially if they're radical leftists who are fiery and passionate and have a lot to say. So we've managed just to, you know, get agreements with everyone from Sophie Wiener, who used to work at Splinter and is an awesome writer in her own right, to Ellie Valley, renowned leftist cartoonist who will be doing our front cover. Really excited about that. To newer writers like Jaya Sundaresh, who's written for Current Affairs but is still emerging as a journalist.
Jaya has been on the show, actually.
You're kidding me. No way. I did not know that. She's a good Twitter friend. But yeah, she'll be in our second issue. And the whole list can be seen on our Kickstarter, and we've announced it on Twitter as well. But it is just really a fantastic lineup.
Well, you know, Tyler, I wanted to ask you a little bit about maybe the first issue, if listeners want to check that out, Pattern Machines. What was the sort of theme you guys were tackling?
So the theme was possibly influenced by the fact that we were all based in San Francisco at the time, but we wanted to critique tech. So that's been done a lot. You know, there's a lot to critique, of course, but we set out to approach it from different angles. And we had mainly ourselves doing most of the writing for the first issue because we knew nobody and had no connections and couldn't afford to pay a lot of people anyways. So I wrote a piece, Stephen wrote a piece, and we had a few friends contribute work as well. But the general idea was critiquing tech from various angles. So we had a critique of the Museum of Ice Cream, which is a weird Instagram-centric selfie factory, basically. I did a critique of social media and addiction and how the, you know, dopamine system and the little dog treats of Twitter make you into a narcotic addict in a lot of ways. And, you know, as someone who's been experienced with addiction, that's something that I saw a lot of analogies to and was troubled by them. Mm-hmm. So similarly, we explored the shifts in identity and self-concept that have happened since the social media age has come to dominate how we relate to each other. There's more fun stuff, like our editor Stephen noticed a correlation in the search terms for, I think it was Donald Trump and cuck, and we put together a half-assed Oedipal theory about conservatives and reactionaries and their weird, repressed, you know, insecure impulses. So, you know, there's a little bit of seriousness, there's some joking, there's a lot of really cool illustrations, and for issue two, the idea is it's going to be all that and more in another professionally produced issue.
What's that?
Not professionally produced, but it'll look good.
Well, you know, I wanted to get into this social media thing, because, you know, having done this podcast for over a year now, it gets really weird at certain points. There's the whole parasocial relationships that people try to create with you. You know, there's this feeling of you constantly have to be plugged into social media, even if you hate being plugged in all the time. What has your experience been with social media? Mel, if you want to take that first, and then Tyler can also give his take.
I think social media is a fucking cancer. I have exactly one social media profile, and it's Twitter, and it takes up way too much of my life. I consistently, on like a regular basis, try to delete the app and deactivate, and I think I last maybe 1 or 2 days. When I first started publishing as a freelance writer in 2016, I was plugged into all these social media channels because the prevailing wisdom at the time, and I think still now, is that you have to be able to market yourself as a freelancer. So you're building a brand that is your name, and you are using social media channels in order to gain a following, because then that will also gain you recognition for your writing and so on and so forth. And it's really, like Tyler says, like, it's really just it's addicting in a really unhealthy way. It leads, particularly among the left, it leads a lot of social organizers who are, you know, bodily able and mentally able to organize in the real to not do that because they feel they have done enough just by retweeting something on Twitter. The thing is like most social media platforms are not connected to each other in any meaningful way. So the sort of discourse that happens on Facebook rarely makes it to Twitter, and the shit on Twitter, unless you've screenshotted it and posted it on Instagram, rarely makes it to Instagram. So you have these insular communities of people screaming at each other into the void, right? Who are seeking recognition for themselves, right? You build this identity that could potentially be authentic if you try really hard enough, you know. But generally speaking, you can create yourself however you would like on social media, and it becomes you lose yourself in that. And for me, you know, with podcasting, I feel that same pull that you feel, that I have to be online, that I have to be available, that I have to be able to respond to people, to respond to DMs, to curate the, you know, for example, the Coffee with Comrades Twitter profile, right? These official sort of brand profiles. And there's actually, we actually did an episode for Coffee with Comrades with Seriously Wrong and the Wrong Boys talking about leftist shitposting and sort of curating this very online leftist brand, right? It's the leftist version of the super online alt writers who end up shooting up malls, right? Like there's a disconnect to the real human element, and you know, you just end up having all these fights over nothing on social media. And when you build that into your identity and you make that a part of your identity, if for whatever reason you fuck up and, you know, the people that you interact with on Twitter decide that they don't want to interact with you anymore, suddenly you are very alone. And, you know, it's a conversation for another day, but like it leads to more isolation and alienation. And that is the exact thing that we are trying to combat as leftists, right? You know what I mean? And so like, for me, social media sucks. That's why I have exactly one profile, and I use it to shitpost, to blow off steam, to talk about my achievements in my academic work, to talk about Protean, to talk about my podcast. And, you know, I have cultivated some really great relationships on Twitter, but I try my best not to make that the focal point of my identity, I suppose.
Well, before I hand it to Tyler, the only thing I would add to that is, you know, just the way Twitter is set up, it prioritizes hot takes. And mm-hmm. I mean, you can't do much with, what's the character limit? Like 200 characters or something? I mean, it's basically set up so that you really can't say anything worthwhile. Everything has to be oversimplified. And it just, I mean, I think that's why it's become such a toxic environment. I don't know. What do you think about that, Tyler?
I think all of what both of you said is definitely true, and Mel is spot on about the isolating, atomizing effects of social media. I will play devil's advocate for a little bit, and Twitter definitely is the devil, but I think that while it's detrimental in so many ways to your attention span, to your, you know, critical mind, to your sense of self, it also offers some benefits in that there are connections that you never would have made before, in that I would not be here on this podcast or would not know Mel if it weren't for Twitter. So I got to say, that's a few marks in its column. I will also admit that I have checked Twitter more than once, even though I'm supposed to be podcasting right now. Mm. But it's definitely something that keeps drawing me back. But it draws me back not only because I'm addicted, even though I certainly am, but because I have made people who I would consider genuine friends on here, which is weird to say, but it's not just parasocial. It's people that, you know, I've gotten to work with in a lot of cool ways and have gotten to support, and they've supported me. And I do have Twitter to thank for that, even though I detest it in every other way.
I mean, I would say that that is it should function as a tool, right? Like, yeah. And we have used it as a tool. We connected on Twitter, and then we, you know, you invited me onto this project, and we've worked this project together. Sorry, Peach, my cat is on my lap. Kitty, get down. No, that way. Sorry. anyway, damn cat. So like the idea there is that social media should absolutely be used as a meeting place, right? But the problem presents itself when it becomes the end all be all of some of a person's life, right? If you use it as a sort of extension, a tool for further communication, relationship building, and on the left, organizing both in the real and like us digital spaces with Protean, then I would say that it's a beneficial part of what is living in the 21st century. But I think a lot of individuals get so wrapped up in what their identity is and what that means to them that they cannot live a life without it. And I would include myself in that group. You know, I can't pretend to be some super dope, like neo Luddite, fuck social media, like fuck technology, I can do this on my own kind of shit, because yeah, some of the most incredible relationships that I've built started on Twitter, and I'm not going to apologize for that. You know, I just think it's really cool that we continue to have this conversation on the left. A lot of podcast episodes have come out in the last couple of months that have really sort of dissected what it means to be a part of a social media generation, and how we can sort of mitigate the potentially traumatic effects of living in virtual reality all the time and not connecting with our real surroundings more, you know. And I think it's important that we continue to have this conversation, and hopefully we reach a point collectively in the discourse where we can find lasting solutions to that isolation and that atomization, and bring that into our organizing spaces more fully.
Well, you know, we're reaching the hour point here. I was wondering, there was just two more things I wanted to cover if you guys have a little bit of extra time.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Well, the first thing, Mel, you mentioned that Coffee with Comrades, it's sort of based on, sincere posting, what people are calling, I guess, new sincerity, in opposition to the sort of post-irony, or are we at post-irony at this point? I can't really tell anymore. It's a subject I think is going to be really important in the future, though, this whole sincerity versus irony debate. And I wanted to get both of your takes on that. I'm beginning to get very uncomfortable with the whole post-irony thing, but I think we all engage in it to some extent.
I think it's a natural extension of just buying fully into meme culture. We're reacting to the absolute devastation that is our current conditions under capitalism in a way that is allowing us to cope with that. And I think that is sort of been taken to its extreme in a lot of circles, particularly online, with the types of shit posting that exist on various social media platforms. You know, it steps over the line into problematic territory often, and it's hard to push back against that in a digital space. I think what Pearson and I have tried to, Pearson first, right? Coffee with Comrades existed for 6 months, 9 months before I ever took over a co-host role. And so Pearson really built into the show this idea of sincerity for the sake of it. And so it allows us as hosts to be very genuine in our opinions and our feelings and our thoughts. And it allows those who we bring on to the show to also feel a measure of respect that maybe they don't necessarily get on in certain social media circles, if that makes sense. I don't claim to be like the bastion of respect and dignity on the podcast left or whatever, but I think like it's really important that what we're trying to cultivate is something that we are also trying to create in our personal lives. And it forms a large portion of our anarchist prefiguration, is that the utopia that we envision, that we are trying to build, the revolution that we want to live every day starts there. It starts with the authenticity, being genuine, being kind, being empathetic, and rooting all of our struggle in militant joy, right? And that isn't to say there isn't a time and a place for shitposting, because God, it's so fun sometimes. But I think that when you start there, the rest of the sort of post irony, the irony for irony's sake, right, just sort of gets lost, as it should. It sort of just blends away because it's not necessarily an important or beneficial way to live your life, I suppose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's odd for me because I tend to avoid a lot of meme talk. Like, I just don't understand the language at times, in the sense that, you know, there's always a million new terms, whether it's soft boy or incel or manic pixie dream girl, although I guess that was, people keep telling me that was pre-meme culture.
But yes.
I get so frazzled by it, because to me, I think a lot of times people will use these sort of meme-speak terms, ironically, but I think sometimes people really buy into these categories to an extent where, like, we sort of dissolve the complexity of people at times. I don't know what either of you may think of that.
Well, I don't know that we can fully reject meme culture. I think it is a very important part of the creation of new media in the digital landscape. And it's using memetics in a way that we haven't necessarily done before, right? Just recently, I went to a workshop put on by the previous, I think Breakaway doesn't exist anymore on Twitter as a group in Chicago, but it was the discussion of the yellow vest of the Gilets Jaunes as a meme and using that as a protest tactic within the larger rational discussion of what it means to participate in insurrectionary politics, which I found fucking awesome, right? It's such an interesting concept. And it's something that, you know, living in a digital landscape, we have the ability to sort of play with this type of media in a way that's intriguing. And the problem, again, moves into problematic territory when the irony gets lost on most people, or becomes cruel, or becomes a facade for extreme opinions and ideologies that are harmful to certain groups. And that is the sort of space that we have to navigate. I don't know, Tyler, you want to jump in?
Yeah. I would just like to say that I hate jokes, and I've never made a joke in my life. So I think I've navigated the chasm between irony and sincerity pretty well, if you ask me.
Oh, my Lord.
But honestly, I think Mel's spot on. It's really a matter of not losing yourself in the internet and its tendency to dissolve the boundaries of yourself and to make your identity bleed into something you may not necessarily want it to. That's what we covered in our first issue, and a lot of what Michael Malloy will be covering in our second. Our legendary poster, Michael Malloy, is joining us with a long piece about the millennial tendency to make jokes about suicide and our own death and the general morbidity and nihilism of that, and how it's a natural expression of late capitalist deterioration, but also kind of worrisome. And these cultures that encourage you to join in with a prefigured format can definitely change your sense of self in ways you may not have anticipated. So you end up with podcasts that start out being ironic and end up as reactionary. And I think, you know, people have pointed out a lot that irony and sincerity can catalyze each other, or irony certainly can lead into becoming a sincere belief if you say it enough times. So, you know, you got to be careful about what you put in your head and keep the jokes to being jokes. And
I mean, that's a meme too, right? Like, I started saying this ironically and now I say it unironically. Like,
yeah, I was just going to say, like, yes, I'm not the first person to make that point, but ironically, that irony thing is a meme. Funny how that works.
I think it's a matter of not not allowing yourself to narrow your perspective to like a single line. You know, it can be very easy to get involved in one online subculture and then think that that is, you know, the whole of the world around you, when it really isn't necessarily. And there's a lot of other different perspectives to take in.
Yeah, and I think Mel hit the nail on the head when she said that it's just about being remaining rooted in compassion and empathy and militant joy. I really like that phrase. Yeah. I think that drives what we do. That drives the politics. You know, we're not like we're not starting out with some complicated economic system that we have in mind and that we want to implement. We judge our politics and our interactions based on moral standards. So as long as we maintain that compass and don't get lost in a weird sea of, you know, post-ironic jokery, then I think we'll be okay. Some of our fellow posters, maybe not, but we're going to do fine.
Agreed.
The last thing I wanted to ask you guys about is when it comes to literature and poetry and all of this stuff online now, I've noticed this weird thing, and this is the reason I contacted you guys, because I liked that there is, you know, with Protean, a sort of leftist space for fiction, poetry, critical thought. It seems like there's a lot of far-right people online that are obsessed with, you know, they want their little space where they can be the literary, you know, heirs to like a Thomas Carlyle or something. And they're really obsessed with being these sort of outsider literature types. What do you guys make of that and the sort of right's obsession with getting in into poetry and fiction spaces online?
You know, I think the right has been used to being the uncool Christian fundamentalists or the nerds for a long time, and they're probably trying to appropriate some of that cachet for themselves. I mean, you get people like Matt Forney, who has the lovely Terror House magazine accepting submissions from all kinds of fascists, and he is a absolute shithead himself. And there's other examples from across the web. That one comes to mind because we had a little kerfuffle with them a while back.
I feel like everyone has had a kerfuffle with that idiot Matt Forney. I swear to God, it's horrifying.
It's like a classic fascist thing. They're looking for a fight, and oftentimes they find one. But as for the right getting into these poetic spaces, I mean, I think there's always been a conservative undercurrent to poetry in some ways. You know, whether it's the CIA funding the Iowa Writers' School, that's more fiction than poetry, but, or, you know, the Poetry Foundation taking donations from oil money and war profiteers. The system is rotten down to the core. So we're trying to build an alternative parallel system.
Do you know about James Angleton? Real quick. James Angleton was the sort of head of the CIA during the Cold War for a long time, and he was real big on counterintelligence, and we have to defeat the Soviets. But his sole, his big inspiration, maybe not his sole inspiration, but his big inspiration for looking at counterintelligence was using New Criticism, which he learned in college. And he also, he befriended Ezra Pound, the Italian fascist poet. And, you know, it's funny because I've always seen New Criticism as being a very sort of right-wing thing. I think it's been more in literary circles and poetry circles than people realize. I didn't mean to interrupt you, though, Mel.
Oh, no. New Criticism finally is something that is no longer pushed as a sort of, like, a proper way to examine literature in the university system. A lot of programs have finally moved away from that shit, which is so nice. But yeah, no, I was just going to say the sort of the prestige politics of reactionary conservative ideas in fiction and literature and poetry is as old as time. and particularly, I find it so infuriating and not at all surprising that the CIA did fund the IR Writers Workshop and turned it into the sort of like gatekeeping prestige program that, you know, you make it in the mainstream as a poet or as a fiction writer if you've made it to the Iowa Writers Workshop, which I just find so boring. And I think that it's really cool to see alternative poetic spaces being created. And they always have been there, you know. It's nice to be able to see it sort of blossoming in a digital landscape where, you know, we are sort of adrift in the digital ocean a little bit. But everywhere you're seeing these various, you know, bastions and holdouts of really beautiful leftist poetry and just generally great humanist poetry, this beautiful fucking awesome shit. I don't know, I'm gonna get off on a tangent, but I just love it so much, and I love that people are sort of experimenting in ways that the digital world can really afford them when it comes to their creative output and what they try to do with language. My nerdy self is all about it. I love it so much.
Well, that's another thing I like about Protean, because I mean, I know so many people that just want to ape whatever they found in the past. Like, I'm a big fan of, like, weird fiction. But ultimately, like, I find people who want to ape, like, H.P. Lovecraft, who is, like, horrifying to read because he's just sort of this insane paranoid racist. I find people that want to ape stuff like that, or, like I said, Thomas Carlyle. I'm like, it's so boring. It's the same thing over and over. I think leftists and a leftist space for fiction, literature, and poetry really can open up new pathways for thought, ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what people like Octavia Butler have always known, is that science fiction and fantasy are fundamentally, or should be, leftist realms, because they offer space to imagine a wholly different world wherein, you know, we can radically reconfigure the systems and the relationships that hold us together. And whether that goes for gender or for politics and economics, there's been a multitude of awesome examples of leftist sci-fi and fantasy. Unfortunately, it's also a breeding ground for reactionaries who want to write about space marines blowing up bugs and shit. So, you know, take what you will out of it.
I mean, you definitely have to sort of navigate that minefield a little bit, but I think that these spaces, every time you see this sort of wholesale rejection of the standards of canon in these genres, right? Because, you know, the big argument among academics is, you know, hard-boiled detective fiction, sci-fi, and fantasy, these genre fiction books, right? Is this literary? Are we examining the, quote, human condition in such a way, you know, this standard, this gatekeeping standard of what is and isn't literary is so infuriating. And to see writers and other creators consistently pushing back against that is really heartening, right? Because you're constantly worried that maybe the literature is going down the shitter, you know, maybe this is the year that, like, we're not going to continue to see this absolute beautiful creative output of individuals who are willing to challenge that. And, you know, I think that becoming a part of that legacy is incredibly important for the present state of media in general and literary media as well, and where we hope to take it in the future as well.
Yeah, and you know, on that note, it's funny because that argument about what constitutes literature, I just think to myself these days, you know, like some of the stuff that passes in New York is, you know, high literature or highbrow, you know, like, or even middle brow, but something like Jonathan Lethem. I'm like, how many more? I mean, I like some of his writing, but how many more books and fiction novels do we need by some lonely hipster dude in Brooklyn? I mean, it's the same thing over and over.
We need in literary fiction, honestly. I mean, you know, there's a lot of bad sci-fi and fantasy out there, but there's a lot of bad literary fiction out there too. So, yeah, I agree that the distinctions between them are a false frame, and you know, who knows where it derives from, but it's the same thing as the CIA pushing a certain narrative in a certain realm of fiction, which is that, you know, fiction should be about an insular world, you know, told through the perspective of a white man and talking about all his affairs.
Yeah, so it should be highly individualist and, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the sort of like universal type of anyone can sort of grab onto this narrative and apply it to their own lives, because that's dangerous. People get ideas when that happens.
Right. Yeah, it was that John Cheever bullshit for years and years, and we're finally dismantling the, you know, the myth of the white genius writer who's an alcoholic and who hates his wife. Finally, there's more space opened up. But I think it should be opened up even further to consider more things that aren't just liberal, which you won't see in The New Yorker.
Yeah, fuck The New Yorker.
Fuck The New Yorker.
I don't know. Though I will say, I would argue that it's not necessarily that finally it's opening up, because there have been fantastic traditions over the last couple of, you know, 200 years or so of black and brown writers who have already sort of kept that space.
True.
So, and so I think that, you know, particularly within literary circles, having this conversation over and over again until we stop thinking the Iowa Writers Workshop is the end all be all of the MFA world, that would be fantastic. That's all I have to say.
Or that you need an MFA at all.
Right.
Well, you know, I was going to say on that note that, you know, I think literature is important because, you know, it things are not always what people believe them to be. And I think literature can open them up to that reality, open people up to that reality. I know on my university campus, I've had to deal with, you know, kids that are dangerously close to being alt-right. And, you know, they have horribly misogynistic views about women, you know, especially this whole idea that, like, women apparently, in their view, they don't have, like, libidos. And I'm like, you can go back to the 1600s. There's women that would write novels about, you know, their libidinous desires. Like, it's not just because of what you were taught when you were growing up by your conservative parents doesn't mean that's true. And we can see that historically through literature. Maybe you guys could comment on that real quick.
Well, I would, you can go back to the 11th and 12th century and read some raunchy fucking poetry written by women. So that's for as long as women have been able to fucking pick up a pen, there has been a literary tradition that sort of falls into that courtly love romantic narrative, right? And I think that the nature of just creativity as in general is an act of rebellion against those types of norms that we find so pervasive in our society. And that that is a tradition that is as long as we've been writing, you know, and I think it will continue for sure.
Well, hey, I want to thank you guys for coming on Parallax Views. Before you go, maybe we can preview issue 2 of Protean. I guess it's called The Anti-Sisyphus. And maybe you could tell my listeners how they can check Protean out and what they can expect in the future from it.
You can check our website at proteanmag.com, where there will be a shop link to purchase our second issue. Additionally, we have our Patreon account at patreon.com/proteanmagazine. And a monthly donation there is always appreciated. If you subscribe at a level of $20 or above, you will get an issue as well as some special bonus features coming up from us. So check us out on Twitter, online, wherever you know, go to check out cool this shit, that's where we'll be.
Do you want to talk a little bit about issue 2 and what we are trying to accomplish with that, Tyler?
Yeah, absolutely. So the theme of issue 2 is moving on from pure critique of tech, like we kind of centered ourselves around in issue 1, and to broaden our horizons to investigate people's emotional responses to capitalism. So we had the idea that we're all burdened with mountains of bullshit every day that's foisted upon us by this system in various ways. Obviously, different people deal with that to different degrees and in different kinds, but we wanted to hear from other people and what capitalist struggles in daily life look to them. So not the big dramatic struggles of, you know, protests and actions, but the small daily things that we tend to overlook and what our emotional reaction is to that on an everyday basis. So whether it's at work, whether it's at home, whether it's in traffic, whether it's interpersonal or something interior, we are trying to find the subtle ways that capitalism slips into the cracks of our existence and root it out and critique it.
And Mel, is there anything you'd like to add? Tell my listeners how they can listen to Coffee with Comrades or anything else on your mind.
Yeah, Coffee with Comrades has a Twitter. It's at CoffeeWComrades. We have a Patreon that's patreon.com/coffeewithcomrades. You can find me on Twitter. You can find Pearson on Twitter as well. Stay tuned because we're going to be sort of slow releasing updates about the Protean podcast, such as what we're going to fucking name it. And it's been a hot debate, really. I'm grateful to be able to participate in this space and to be able to participate in this project specifically. It's something that I have tried to do with various other groups in the past, and to finally catch hold of a group that's kicking ass already is really sweet. And I'm really glad that I've been invited into the collective to do this kind of cool stuff. So
you were too kind, Mel, and we are extremely lucky to have you, because even though, as a couple of white guys, it was probably in our destiny to start a podcast, lucky we have an expert on board that can lead the way.
What's the joke? What do you call a group of white guy leftists? A podcast?
A podcast. I've seen that on my Twitter feed hundreds of times. That doesn't get any less true.
Yep. So, that's it. Thanks for having us on. Thank you for the invite. It's been a really lovely conversation.
I want to thank you guys for providing my listeners with a bit of a parallax view.
Hey.
Of course.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Mel and Tyler of Protean Magazine. If you haven't checked out the first issue, Pattern Machines, I hope after listening to our discussion, you will head on over to Protean and maybe buy a print or digital copy of that first issue. It is fascinating reading, folks. Also, check out the Coffee with Comrades podcast that our guest Mel helps host. And on my end, if you could, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Parallax Views After Hours is available to Patreon supporters for just $5 a month. I release bonus episodes, and, you know, to be honest, I release about 3 to 4 shows on the main feed a week at this point. That's the groove I'm getting into. So most of the content is not behind a paywall, but I could really use your help. So even donating $1 is just absolutely great for the Parallax Views project. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.